Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one, we look at The Arm, a new book about professional baseball players, pitchers, and the increasing epidemic of serious arm injuries. What's going on in baseball? In part two, we'll be talking with a British veterinarian about dogs. Stay with us. Recently, while reading Sports Illustrated magazine, I had the chance to read a fascinating article, which in fact was an excerpt from an incredible new book called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports, by sports writer, sports columnist Jeff Passan. This is a story which needs to be told, and needs to be told much more prominently than it has been up until now. It is the story of what some characterize as an epidemic in which brutal injuries are being sustained by baseball pitchers, young and old alike, in many cases necessitating a radical kind of surgery known as a Tommy John. And in some cases, careers are resuscitated and revived. In some cases, arms are ruined and careers are finished. And what's especially scary is when one sees devastating injuries being suffered by young kids, sometimes teenagers, sometimes even younger than that, all because people are pursuing dreams of baseball greatness, but perhaps pushing their bodies beyond natural limits. Jeff Passan, a baseball lover and the father of a young boy who loves baseball, cares about this topic on a number of different levels and has done a masterful job of exploring this important issue from all kinds of different perspectives. The book is published by HarperCollins. Again, it's called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. Jeff Passan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I appreciate it.
I'm really glad we can talk about this. There are a couple things just right from the title and subtitle of the book that I think can help kind of propel our conversation forward. One of them is that notion towards the end of the subtitle when you talk about the arm of a pitcher being the most valuable commodity in sports. And in the prologue to the book, you share some numbers that are staggering that help us understand just how much is riding on the arms of major league pitchers. Describe this scenario to our listeners.
Well, it's very simple. $1.5 billion plus a year are spent on pitchers by major league teams. This year, it's closer to $1.7 billion, actually. And that's five times as much as every quarterback salary combined in the NFL and as much as the top 200 NBA players' salaries. And so it's a staggering amount of money being spent. And the thing about baseball, especially over the last 15 years or so, is how much the industry prides itself on efficiency and on capitalizing on the markets and the areas of the market that other teams haven't quite found solutions for yet. Nobody understands the arm. And so to spend $1.5 billion on something that they don't understand, it was a very confusing thing for me, and really the impetus behind this book. I wanted to understand why these seemingly intelligent, rational people were so confounded by this complicated machine that is the arm.
So that's the mystery that you are referring to in the subtitle, the billion-dollar mystery.
Yeah, it's that we've been studying the arm for a century plus now, and even the smartest among us, even the doctors and the researchers who have dedicated their lives to this, still don't fully understand what's going on inside of the arm, even when someone's throwing a pitch.
And what it's hard to know where to begin, but maybe we should begin with this thing called the ulnar collateral ligament, because in most cases, this is what goes wrong. It is something in the body that is essential to a baseball pitcher's livelihood, and yet it is, in your words, ill-equipped to stand up long-term to the single fastest movement that the body can generate, the throwing motion. Tell us more about the UCL and what intrinsically, in a sense, is wrong with it, or what's wrong with the way that we treat it when it comes to a game like baseball.
Well, it's just a very simple 2-inch band of tissue that ties together the upper and lower arms. And, the ulnar collateral ligament didn't used to be as big of a deal as it is now, because the evolution of pitching injuries has gone from shoulders down to elbows. It used to be rotator cuffs and torn labrums would derail careers, but baseball's gotten a lot smarter. It understands you can strengthen muscles, and the stronger muscles are, the less likely they are to become a problem long term. The issue with that is that the arm will always find the weakest point. And if your shoulder is strong, then all of the potential energy that gets built up during the delivery and propels your arm forward at 8,000 degrees per second, faster than an eye blink, is going to go straight to the ulnar collateral ligament. And the UCL can take only so much stress and strain before it breaks. And that's what we've seen more and more frequently, and especially troubling at younger and younger ages. That's why when, I use the word epidemic, I don't use that word lightly. It's not just in the major leagues or in the minor leagues, but between 2007 and 2011, the most recent data that we have publicly available, 56.8% of Tommy John surgeries were on children 15 to 19 years old.
That's one of the scariest and most disturbing things about this. Back to the pitching motion for just a moment, because I so appreciate, especially because I'm no baseball player, so I appreciate the time that you take kind of talking about the mechanics of the typical baseball pitch, which at one point you describe as beautifully chaotic and chaotically beautiful. Can you take us inside those intriguing words?
Well, I think the beautifully chaotic part is the fact that all of these disparate pieces of the delivery are combining together to make something that actually works. And it's not just your arm when you're throwing a pitch. It's your ankle and how, the degrees of dorsiflexion in your ankle. And it's building up the energy through your legs and up your behind and up your back and into your shoulder. And the chaotically beautiful part, I think, is just the aesthetics of the whole thing, that you have all of these things combining to make for a ball coming out of an arm upwards of 100 miles per hour at times. And I, as somebody who cannot throw 100 miles per hour, I find that to be really a pretty miraculous thing that people are capable of doing.
You make mention repeatedly of what seems to be a growing fixation in baseball at all levels, certainly in professional baseball, a fixation with velocity. And at first, I didn't quite catch what you were saying. Again, I'm not the biggest baseball aficionado, but it started to dawn on me that I think what you're talking about is that once upon a time, there was maybe a more comprehensive sense of what good pitching was, and that a lot of pitching was about placement and maybe guile. And now more and more there seems to be a focus on sheer speed. And with that increased focus on speed, that at least is one serious contributing factor to the epidemic that you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's honestly the one thing that I have trouble solving for, because velocity works, and it works really well. Guys who throw harder strike out more hitters. Guys who throw harder give up fewer home runs. In the modern game, those are the two greatest attributes a pitcher can have. Does he strike people out, and does he limit home runs? And so not only that, velocity is much easier, I think, to learn through different training modalities than command and control, which is getting the ball over the plate and putting it where you want it to be. And so when you've got this huge desire among teams for velocity, that encourages kids to try and throw harder. And when you have kids at young ages trying to throw hard, that's not a good thing necessarily. It's troublesome, frankly. And it's the thing that I think, as much as any, along with overuse, is leading to all of these injuries at young ages. And because of that, I think we're setting the wrong examples, and our priorities are off. You know, it's not about competition at a young age. It's about development. And until we get that notion through the heads of parents and coaches, I think we're going to have the same problems. And frankly, I could see them getting even worse.
We're speaking with Jeff Passan about his book called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. We're talking about the pitching arm and how there is, in a sense, an epidemic at play right now, with so many pitchers at every level of the game experiencing more and more serious arm injury, particularly injury to the UCL, which is so critical to a pitcher's well-being. I'm glad that you take a historically long view of this, even though the primary focus of your book is on kind of the current scenario and how we got here. But you share some interesting baseball history along the way, including the fact, I think you tell us at some point, is it 1883 or 1884? That's when we first started to see overhand throwing in organized baseball. And of course, for decades, it would seem that that there wasn't a whole lot happening like we are seeing now in terms of a rash of terrible injuries. Or is that just sort of lost to us in the obscurity of history? Or is it that there is a lot going on now that makes this so much more rampant than it once was?
No, I think the injuries in the past actually were about as frequent as the injuries in the present. And it shouldn't be that way because of our advances in medicine. One would think that as much as we know now compared to back in the 1950s, when they were still pulling players' teeth, thinking that the teeth were sending a poison down to the shoulder, and that is what was causing shoulder soreness. I mean, even in the last 50 years, we've just had leaps and bounds advancements, but it's still not at the point now where we know enough to be able to prevent these things. It's almost like we can cure them afterward, but a preventive measure would be so much better than the surgery and having to have your arm essentially immobilized for a few months and then having to handle it with kid gloves for up to 15 months, which is generally the required and desired time for Tommy John surgery rehabilitation.
Speaking of Tommy John surgery, you tell us that it is a paradox because, in your words, it was a procedure that worked too well. Tell us the way in which it is this kind of a paradox. I mean, quite a successful procedure, and yet in a sense, something that has perhaps aggravated the problem as much as it has alleviated it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a false sense of security when it comes to Tommy John surgery. You think, okay, I'll just get my TJ done and I'll come back better than ever, but it really isn't that easy. It's not just the rehabilitation that's difficult. It's the knowledge that the greatest predictor of a future arm injury is a past arm injury. So you are at significantly greater risk when you've had an ulnar collateral ligament tear in the past. And you know, Freddie Gonzalez, the Atlanta Braves manager, said that I look at it like a root canal now. I don't know any root canals where you get your arm cut open, you get a drill into the bones of your arm, you have a tendon taken from somewhere else on your body, and you tie the elbow together that way. I understand the sentiment he was trying to convey, which is the success rate of Tommy John surgery to return at your previous level is about 80%, but staying there and performing like you did in the past, it's not that high. And so the idea that Tommy John is some foolproof surgery is just not true. Unfortunately, I fear that baseball treats it that way. And it's the one place now where I can see the sport sort of harkening back to its old days where pitchers were considered fungible. The lack of respect for the seriousness of Tommy John surgery among some people is alarming.
And you're saying that's still in place. That's not just something from the good old days.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's people think Tommy John surgery is a cure-all. And, on the contrary, it's a massive problem. And I think instead of seeing it through the lens of 80% of people come back, you should see it through the lens of 100% of people are missing 12 to 15 months at a time and having uncertain futures.
Tell us about the two pitchers into whose lives you stepped and whose experiences you follow so closely in your book. And I imagine you are really, really grateful to Mr. Hudson and Mr. Coffey for allowing you into their lives at a really difficult point for both of them.
Exceedingly grateful. I mean, can't put into words grateful, because Daniel Hudson and Todd Coffey, two major league pitchers, were at the nadir of their lives. They had just lost their livelihoods and were facing a grueling one-year process to get back. And they allowed me to go into the operating room with them. They allowed me to follow their lives, to talk with their families, to really understand what all of this entails. And, I don't think this book has nearly the impact it does without their stories being told, because they bring a very human element to a very mechanical thing such as the arm. And, I mean, it's a limb. You know, what is there to say about a limb? Well, it's how the limb affects people in their lives, and I think that Todd and Dan's lives illustrate that as well as anything possibly could.
Right. You take Major League Baseball to task for fostering, in your words, an environment in which all 30 teams treat pitchers' health as proprietary information instead of banding together to solve the sport's greatest mystery. You feel that Major League Baseball teams need to be working in much greater cooperation with one another when it comes to this issue.
They do. Injury prevention is seen as a competitive advantage these days, whereas I think the moral view of it is that injury prevention should be something that's prioritized for everybody. And you pool your resources and let it go that way. Now, Major League Baseball is doing a study, I think, five organizations from a draft class a couple of years ago, just following them, trying to do as deep of a longitudinal study as it can. And they've got epidemiologists working on injury data that they've been collecting for the last, I think, 6 or 7 years now. And so there are things that MLB is doing that are correct and are proper and are warranted. The problem is MLB is just an entity that oversees all of these teams, and I don't think it has the power to go in and say, we need you to give up whatever research you have right now and join the cause. I'd love to see them do that. I think they should do that, but I don't see that in the foreseeable future.
Tell our listeners what happened on July 27th, 2015 in Cooperstown, New York.
Ah, thank you. I needed that cue. I was going to say, did I have like a sandwich or something? I don't remember. John Smoltz was being inducted into the Hall of Fame, and he is the first pitcher to go in with a scar on his elbow from Tommy John surgery. And he stood up there on the stage and used his platform to encourage kids to not play baseball year-round, because John Smoltz, unlike so many people out there, knows that if you play year-round baseball, you are five times likelier to suffer an arm injury from pitching than kids who don't play at least 8-plus months of the year. And so using his time up there on the dais at Cooperstown and the audience that he had to discourage year-round baseball and encourage health among kids, I think was the absolute best use he could have possibly had for that time. And I personally appreciated it, because seeing players and seeing people who have the amount of respect that John Smoltz has stand up and talk about this, it just doesn't happen often enough.
A last quick question. What does this book, what does this story have to do with your young son?
My son is 8 years old, and he's starting kid pitch right now, and I am his pitching coach, and honestly, it scares me to death, because I know that no matter how conscientious I am, and I will be the most conscientious parent out there, there's still a chance that he or any of the other kids on the team could still get hurt. No matter what we do to change things, there are always going to be injuries. I just like to think we can do a better job of limiting them.
The book, again, is The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports, published by HarperCollins, the author, Jeff Passan. Jeff Passan, thank you for writing this important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate you having me.
The time is 8:32, and you are listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of the program is coming up in just a moment. If any of you own a dog, like I own a dog, or two dogs actually in my case, you need to think very seriously about getting in your hands a wonderful new book called Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. It's a beautiful book full of wonderful illustrations, and even more important than all the illustrations and photographs are all the insights that are shared by veterinarian Dr. Bruce Fogel, who is joining me via the telephone from London, England, from his veterinary clinic to talk about this wonderful animal and the way in which they enrich our lives and the way in which we can better care for them. Bruce Fogel has written a number of different books, including The Dog's Mind and 101 Questions Your Dog Would Ask Its Vet. And this latest book is in so many different ways very evidently a labor of love. It's published by Firefly Books, Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. And Dr. Bruce Fogel, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
I love this book, and I think anyone who owns a dog will deeply appreciate it as I do. I really appreciate a moment in the introduction when, in your words, you take a moment to talk about the species on the other end of the leash. That is not the dog, but the human owner.
Sure.
And you make such an interesting observation there about the typical human being's capacity to connect with dogs. And so often we talk about it in reverse, but I don't ever remember reading a book about dogs which explored this particular matter.
Well, you mentioned I'm a vet. I've been in clinical practice for 40 years. Ended up in London by accident, started off in Toronto, but somehow I ended up here. And after I'd been in practice for, I don't know how long, let's say 7 years, I was getting fairly relaxed at my clinical diagnoses, but I was becoming more questioning about understanding the relationships that I saw between the people who brought dogs in and those dogs. Quite frankly, I didn't understand some of the things that I was seeing and disagreed with some of the things that I saw. I found it tough when somebody would come in and say, I love this dog more than anybody in the whole world, and kiss it on the lips. Mm. And I'd go, that's wrong. You've got a family. You've got kids. You've got a husband. How can you love a dog more than any of those people? And in fact, what I was able to do was the Veterinary Association allowed me to organize a symposium, and this was back in 1980, that we called the Human Companion Animal Bond. And what I did was I invited ologists from around the world, psychologists, anthropologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, to talk about the relationship that we have with our pets, dogs and cats primarily, and some other pets, and to look at that relationship from the various different perspectives that they had. And a number of these were dispassionate perspectives. These were people who were interested in why, on any given day, well over half of all North American homes have a dog or a cat. At one point, it was up to 70% of all homes in the States and Canada had dogs or cats. Now, most of those homes had kids. So a dog can't just be a child substitute because most of those families already have had the real McCoy. So why do we burden ourselves with them financially and emotionally? And it was an eye-opening 3 days for me. One of the things I learned from the psychiatrist when I said, well, I just disagree with some of the stuff I'm seeing, they said, well, you're being judgmental. Why should you impose your judgments on what they're doing? How do you know that what you think is right and what they're doing is wrong? Which is a pretty good lesson for a young vet to have.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that came, in my mind, a better appreciation of the hidden values in the relationship we have with dogs. One of the most interesting was from a cultural anthropologist from MIT, a woman named Connie Perrin. Connie was researching a book on middle-class, middle-American neighboring. And in the process of doing it, Connie, who had never lived with a cat or a dog, found that, as she described it, pets were either the glue or the solvent of neighborly relationships.
Well put.
And that took her off into a delightful tangent on, well, what is it about these animals that make them so popular? Well, she was aware of some research that a man named Aaron Ketcher, a psychiatrist, had done at the University of Pennsylvania, showing that if you stroke your dog, your blood pressure drops, your diastolic blood pressure drops, your state of arousal is diminished, that you get physiological rewards from stroking your own dog. You don't necessarily get them from stroking a dog that you haven't formed a relationship with, but you do from the dog you have formed a relationship with. Ketcher noticed other things as well. He noticed that in his observations at the teaching hospital at the University of Pennsylvania, men would tickle and cuddle and fondle their dogs just as much as women would. And men would very often speak in a voice that was slightly higher. Hello, little doggy. That we're willing to do things like that with our pets, but we feel embarrassed about showing emotion in public with our spouses, for example. So a lot of observational work had been going on in the 70s, and Connie took all of that, and she took work that had been done on parenting and the relationship between the mother and child. It was work that was done by a British psychologist named Winnicott, who did the work on the first work on when the baby is born for the first year, 18 months, the baby thinks that it is part of mummy. And let's say at around 18 months of age, infants start to realize they're not part of mummy, that they have to stand on their own 2 feet, and that leads to the terrible twos. She pulled all of this together, and she looked at the way people behave with their dogs, that we physiologically get comfort from them in an identical way that the baby gets physiological rewards from touching mummy. She looked at the way owners talk about their dogs. Their dogs can do no wrong, even when we know our dogs have done wrong. My dog didn't poop on your lawn. We know full well that it was our dog that did it. She looked at all of that, how we'll fantasize that our dogs will protect us that if I fall in the river, my dog's going to jump in and save me. And in reality, if we really think about it, our dogs will jump in because it looks like a giggle rather than to actually save you. And she decided, and she concluded that pets provide us with a form of love, or what we interpret as love, and something that, in fact, she described as superabundant love that was quite different from the four or five other types of love that we can experience with our spouses, our parents, our children, our possessions. And she said that in that sense, our pets, in a curious way, are parent substitutes, as well as child substitutes.
Wow.
And it was this parent substitution that created such an intense bond. And as society is changing today, and as I've seen it change during the time that I've been in practice, the more I've thought about it, the more I agree with her. There are various things in our culture, and by our culture, I mean Western culture, American, Canadian, British, German, French. There are changes that have occurred in our culture where the totems that held culture together, the three-generation family, the role of religion and of your minister, your priest, these have, in many cases, lost their importance or have disappeared from modern culture. And you could say, in a negative sense, dogs have slipped into the void. Dogs and cats, for that matter, will still provide us with a feeling of constancy, of security. They're reliable, they're immutable, they're always there, they're never changing. The world can become a horrible place in many ways, but the dog is always there by your side, understanding you.
And this must be at least one of the main reasons why your observation has been in your practice over the last several decades, that people are becoming more attached, not less attached,
yeah,
to their dogs. I mean,
yeah,
you and your colleagues have observed this.
And did you grow up with dogs?
Yes.
Do you remember where they lived? Because very often, certainly in my generation, the dog had a doghouse outside, and if it was cold, the dog slept in the kitchen, certainly if you had a big dog. And where I lived in Ontario, it was mostly big dogs. But from the kitchen, they moved into the living room and then up onto the sofa, and eventually they migrated into the bedroom. And anybody who's listening who has a dog knows that you give any dog an inch and the dog will be up on the bed, snuggling with you, because that's where they want to be. And where 30 or 40 years ago, that would have been less common, today it's virtually the normal. And you look at something like an Orvis catalog. I just got my Orvis catalog today, which is why it comes to mind. And it isn't just dog beds that they're selling. They're selling things specifically to put on your bed, knowing full well that your dog is going to be sleeping up there. And it's a picture of a Labrador snoozing at the bottom of the bed while the husband and wife are reading. That's just what's changed. And whether it's good or bad, that's not for me to say. And I should interject that I do let my golden retriever up on the bed. So...
Well, and
so I've gone to the far side as well.
Sure. My wife and I would probably do the same, except we have two golden retrievers and literally not enough room for both of them.
Awful lot of dog.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Bruce Fogel, and we're talking about his book, Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. And it is a beautiful book full of wonderful photographs and all kinds of interesting information about dogs. In a chapter called What Makes a Modern Dog, you explore a couple of things that I think are often a matter of curiosity for dog owners. And one of them is the matter of intelligence. How intelligent is your particular dog, and how does it compare to the intelligence of your sister-in-law's dog? Versus how about the emotional level of a given dog? Can you talk about those two matters and the way and to what extent we're able to even know about such matters, and also the way in which such things can or should be measured?
There, when we use the word intelligence, if you go into any breed club's definition of their breed, the description of the ideal of that breed. Every breed is described as intelligent, and I'm sure everybody who has written breed descriptions has a different definition of what they mean by intelligence. So, for example, I can I happen to live with I've got a golden retriever. My kids, my two kids who live near me have four Labradors or almost Labradors, two pure Labradors. One's a lab collie cross, the other's a lab with a smattering of poodle in it. And many people will think these are intelligent dogs, and Stanley Coren, in his excellent book, on, I think called The Intelligence of Dogs, had the Labrador up near the top with the standard poodle and the border collie up at the top. But that definition was really based on trainability, on the ease with which you can train your dog to obey command. Now, some other dog might think a Labrador is just a jerk for being willing to do everything that people ask it to do. And they could another dog might think that's the exact opposite of intelligence, that the intelligent dog listens to what it's being instructed to do and goes, well, I understand that, but why should I do it? So I've studiously avoided using the word intelligence in anything that I've written, and I've written a fair bit. There's a little bit of on that. In this book, the publisher first said, write whatever you want, and then, of course, accountants look at the size of a book and said, we have to cut 10% of this book. So that meant two chapters got cut, and one of them had to do with intelligence. And in fact, anybody who wants to read the cut bit that has not been edited, I stuck it on my website on brucefogel.com. The chapter on intelligence and a chapter on dogs and religion are there. With regard to your question about, with regard to intelligence, you have to define, as far as I'm concerned, we have to define what we mean by it. And dogs will have emotional intelligence, and some have greater emotional intelligence than others. Some will have territorial intelligence. They can map territories far better than others do. Others are absolutely superb at watching our body language and understanding what we mean, to the extent that better than any other species, we can simply look with our eyes in a direction, and a dog can understand that they should follow the gaze of our eyes at something that's down on the ground. And dogs do that better than any primate or better than any other animal. Hmm. As for their emotions, I still meet people who feel that that animals work on autopilot, that only humans have true emotions. And I just can't accept that. I think that the various emotions that we have evolved to serve various purposes in our lives. And animals have those as well. And in fact, there have been wonderful studies showing that even a pigeon can feel jealousy. and so those emotions are there. And we can read them in our dogs fairly readily because dogs use a whole range of body language that is not dissimilar to primate body language. And they're probably even better than we are at reading it in us. They don't have the big frontal cortexes that we have, so they can't think in the abstract way that we can to as sophisticated a degree. So they have to rely on interpreting body language, for example, or scent. Needless to say, they're spectacularly good at picking up scent. But I don't think there's a vet in practice who hasn't been told dozens of times by a pet owner that they might come home from work and they're feeling a bit blue and they sit down and the dog just comes over and lays its head on their lap. And the dog is picking up a signal, it's picking up something in that body language and comes over and makes physical contact. And that's just sociability. They're pack animals. They're sociable, and it's a comforting response that the dog innately has an ability to perform. And that's because they read our emotions so spectacularly well.
I wonder if you could explain to our listeners a very interesting chart that's in a later chapter in the book called Our Relationship with Dogs, in which it is possible, at least in a fairly rough way, but I think in a way that could be truly meaningful, to actually measure the level of your attachment to your dog. And some interesting questions are posed there and so on. I wonder if you could just explain a little about what this is, and also if you feel like this is something that everybody who owns a dog should do. That is, take this little questionnaire as it is and try to ascertain their level of attachment to a dog. Is there something helpful or useful in knowing that?
Yeah, that was I found when I filled that out, I was actually embarrassed. I think it was the University of Tennessee. I'm pretty certain it was University of Tennessee. Some psychologists there developed an attachment inventory that people could fill out as a self-assessment of their attachment to their pets, with a maximum score, I think, of 30. And I filled it out, and I hit 30. Then my wife Julia filled it out, and she hit 30, and my kids filled it out. They all hit 30, and I wondered how valid that was. But it's an accepted self-assessment score to see what your level of attachment is. Now, I'll see in families that the person who brings the dog in, if they filled in that score, would hit 30. And that person very often is the woman in the family. And then her husband might bring the dog in on a different occasion. And if he were to fill in the score, he might hit 21, 22. There will be different levels of attachment. And I think it's very good. It would be fun for families to actually run that and see if there are differences within it. What lots of vets in practice will be confronted with is the distressing situation where you've made a diagnosis of a complicated problem, and treating that problem is going to be expensive. And there's just no way around the fact that it's going to be expensive. It might involve complicated surgery. It might involve expensive drugs. And at that point, that attachment to the pet manifests itself. And for example, that's where I will meet a husband for the first time. The wife and kids will bring the dog in. But now it's a question of money. Should we really invest all of that money when we're struggling to make ends meet in prolonging that dog's life? If you've got a great attachment to it, then the answer is yes, you will. And if you're less attached, then you're more pragmatic about it. So in that sense, I think it's a good score, and I'm delighted that psychologists are actually looking at the relationship between people and animals, not just the relationship between people and people.
Hmm. The book goes on to take us through canine infancy and what you call puppyhood and adolescence, and of course ultimately to old age, and ultimately to some of those questions which you were just raising. At some point in the book, you bring up the fact that dogs, of course, live out their lives in a different arc than you and I do, or at least we that's typically the way it works, that we outlive our dogs typically by a very significant degree. And I think your book makes that point in a very interesting way, that it's important for us to be aware of that, and in a sense of how rapidly our dogs change and how their needs evolve. And we need to be ready for that.
Yeah, they get to the point where they're geriatric babies, as it were, in the babies in the... they might be have these parenting skills in that they are subconsciously in our minds they provide us with certain values as parents, but we do care for them the way we care for our kids. We take them to the vet when they're not feeling well. We provide them with the security of our home. We want them to be warm. We want their nutrition to be good. And suddenly you've got an old dog. And in fact, of all the things I've written, I wrote an article for a national newspaper in the UK called The Independent, and another national newspaper called The Daily Mail published it the next day, republished it the next day. And I had a greater response to that article when my, in fact, quite young dog, a dog that I'd taken on a trip around the States for a book called Travels with Macy. I retraced John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, 40 years after he had done it, with my then golden retriever. And this dog developed a horrible disseminated cancer, and she died at 6 years of age. I wrote an article about the loss of that dog, and the response was overwhelming. And one of the interesting things to me was that on the Daily Mail's webpages, readers logged their comments, and around 75% of those who logged their comments were women. Of the letters that I got, around 75% of the letters were from men. Men didn't want to say in public on a website the torment that they went through when their dog died. But here I was, a guy and a vet, talking about how I felt when my dog died, and they wanted to share with me personally in a letter what they experienced. And I think that may well be on the brucevogel.com website as well from a few years ago. I can't remember. But we have to somehow prepare ourselves, and it's almost impossible to prepare ourselves, because they go through this, as you described it aptly, an arc from infancy, which we really don't see because they're with the breeders at that point. And then we get them in what I described as once infancy, that first 6, 7, 8 weeks is over, and we have them through puppyhood, which can be exasperating because we think we've got a dog, but we haven't. We've got a puppy. It's like a different species to a dog. And then the rebellion of adolescence, and the girlies will rebel as well. And those of us who've had male dogs know that some of them take themselves off to tattoo parlors when they're 15 to 18 months of age, and and parts of their personality that you just didn't think was there suddenly comes out. And finally, you get into the calm of adulthood, and that's when dogs are genuinely wonderful fun. But that doesn't last that long, and they suddenly, they're old. And old can mean 8 years of age if you're an Irish wolfhound, or old might not be until you're 14 or 15 if you're a small poodle. Old varies with your size and your breed, but you get there too soon, too fast.
It remains
the toughest part of practice.
Right. Sooner than you'd like, we arrive at that. And it's a reality. And of course, it helps all of us learn something about life and not taking it for granted, whether it's our own life or the life of those we love or the life of the pets we love.
Exactly.
I just love the way your book was put together with such great care and with every facet of a dog's life in mind, and with every facet of our relationship to our dogs in mind as well. The book, again, is called Dog, The Definitive Guide for Dog Owners. It is published by Firefly Books and the author, Dr. Bruce Fogel. Dr. Fogel, thank you so much for this. I enjoyed your book so much and our chance to talk about it.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you very much.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching.